This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I invited you here today because, you know, I need you to be here on The Orb, because you're always here, but I'm not sure I have much for you to do today. Are you okay with that?
As long as I get to listen to Irving Berlin and you serve some Romulan ale, sure.
Yeah. Okay, I might let you press a few buttons also, if that makes you happy.
Can Troy's hand be over my hand, then?
Sure, why not?
Okay, because, I mean, at least, you know, I don't know, there's something about her. There's a little electricity. Just
Yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. I can also let you shoot some things if you want.
Oh, now, and if I get to shoot things, yeah, I'm totally in.
Okay, let me ask you one more question.
Okay.
I have some friends who are going to have a wedding coming up soon, they want me to invite. They don't have enough people right now, which is unusual, I know, for a wedding.
Okay.
But they're trying. They've asked me to gather some people to come to the wedding, but there's one catch. Mm-hmm. You have to come with no clothes on. Would you be okay with that?
Well, I mean, I don't really want the bride to run away with me instead of the groom, so I feel like I should probably say no.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Last question. If we get a phone call, could you answer that for us and tell whoever it's for that someone's on the phone for them?
Chris, hold on. Yep. Hey, Chris, the phone's for you.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You know, this sounds like everything that Worf got to do in Nemesis, right?
I'm trying to think if there's anything that we missed. And I believe he got to have a glass of wine. So,
oh, yes, the
can
wine.
You please give me some Chateau Picard? That would be great.
Right. I have a bottle right over here.
Okay, fantastic. Okay.
Okay, so of course today we're going to wrap
it,
up.
Chris.
I know. So of course today we're going to wrap up our four-part series on Worf's journey to Deep Space Nine, where we're talking about his roles in the TNG films as well as DS9 and how they played together. Now, the final film, Nemesis, takes place 4 years after the end of DS9, so obviously it's not really part of his journey to DS9. It's more like his journey back to TNG from DS9, but we're going to talk about it anyway because it is one of the TNG films.
And we're back at the Tactical Officer's Station.
Yes, and with no chair.
Yeah, I mean, he never had a chair, you know, at the Horseshoe, so, I mean... Yeah, Worf's always had to stand. Poor
yeah,
guy.
So that takes it back. It's original. It's authentic in that case. So, Matthew, we covered pretty much everything Worf got to do in the movie there in our opening. But just in case, I have a nutshell synopsis of Nemesis from Worf's perspective. So
cool.
Here it is.
I'm really excited.
In this movie, Worf attends a wedding, thinks Romulan ale should be illegal, gets a headache listening to Irving Berlin, but at least we know he studied up on composers after Insurrection, doesn't want to go to a wedding naked, rides in the back seat of a dune buggy, calls Data Captain Obvious, shoots at aliens, has to sit way down at the end of the table during a briefing, far away from the rest of the crew for some reason, gets shot down by Picard when he suggests raising shields. Realizing that they really needed their shields up, he insists on doing it anyway, but he still gets told no. So he gets told no twice right there. Then he visits a dark room and watches other people talk. He beams a ship aboard. He takes a phone call, transfers it to Picard. He plays Ouija board with Troy, compliments the Romulans, roams the corridors, shoots Remans, disappears for a long time, comes back, toasts Data, and then disappears for the rest of the movie.
See, I think what happened here, Chris, is that Worf was really playing out that whole question of can you go home again? Worf realizes yeah. You can't go home again because life's just not the same, and maybe it is the same or even worse for you. Right. So,
you know, it's interesting because we're always talking, you and I especially are always talking about character growth and character development. And this is one of the biggest cases in Star Trek of regressive character development, right? Where he was on DS9 and where he is now, it's just such an enormous step back. It's like if Worf decided, this is just not for me. I'm just going to give up and go back and just do the easiest thing that I can think of.
It's kind of like saying, you know what? I don't want to be the CEO anymore. I'm going to go back and work at McDonald's. You know, yeah. Like it just doesn't make any sense. And not only that, but I just watched the movie again and realized that they do the same thing for Data again. I don't know where his emotion chip is. I know that wasn't taken with him during the insurrection mission. I got corrected by that by a lovely listener, sent us a great email, reminded me that was a line in Insurrection that I forgot about. Okay. And here, though, it's like he doesn't have it at all. And it's like, what is going on with these TNG writers that they are totally forgetting their own material? That's just ludicrous.
Well, forgetting it or feeling that it's not convenient for the story, and so let's just pretend like it never existed.
Right, like Picard not having hair, but having hair yeah. in the past, because we've already seen him in that past, so...
Yeah. All right. Well, although I will say, at the end of this movie, the fact that Shin Zon gets stabbed through the heart is at least a nice connection to what happened to Picard when he was young. That at least, you know, Picard didn't die because he got the artificial heart, but he would have died otherwise. So at least they met the same potential fate in any case.
It just reminds me of the Bon Jovi song, Shot Through the Heart, and You're Too Late. Darling, you give love a bad name. So yeah, that Shin Zon, he's just no good in this film.
I like how you didn't sing that. You just said it. It's like William Shatner on his more recent albums where he just speaks the lyrics to things like She Blinded Me with Science or Duran Duran's Planet Earth.
You know, Bon Jovi is just a little bit out of my range when I'm not in the car or I've been drinking, you know, with friends. So it's just, it was better for the listeners for me not to try. yeah.
All right. Well, let's, now that I've done the rundown of the movie from Worf's perspective, let's talk about the timeline just briefly, just to put this movie in perspective, because it plays into why Worf is on the Enterprise. So in terms of the timeline, when does Nemesis take place? It takes place on Stardate 56844.9, which is in the year 2379. That's 4 years after the end of Deep Space Nine, which is 2375. 52902.0, and also the end of Voyager, which I mentioned because Janeway has a cameo in here. Voyager ended on Stardate 54973.4, which is 2378, so roughly a year, maybe a little bit less than a year before this mission.
And for some reason, they've made her an admiral, which still doesn't make sense to me. I mean, she's been a captain for, what, 7 years? And
yeah.
I know she was in the Delta Quadrant and they survived and all, but really, Admiral? Like, she gets home and immediately gets a promotion instead of like, you know what? We're going to need to evaluate you for a while. And nope.
Yeah.
It just seems like that's a really big promotion for somebody who just got back from the Delta Quadrant, and they immediately slap a new rank on her and like, here you go, give her more power. Just weird.
It's true, but, you know, in the future time frame in Endgame, I guess she was an admiral, right? So they have
to make
that connection. I guess for the viewer, it's easier to just make that connection, but it does seem, like you say, a very fast promotion.
Yeah. What's strange about it just was the fact that, you know, 2378, they get home. 2379, she's an admiral. Who knows actually how long they were actually home, you know, when they get home in 2378. It's just an odd thing for all of a sudden for her to already be an admiral. Although, of course, we know from Jerry Ryan, they asked her to be in Nemesis as well when they were in the planning stages, and she said no. So we could have also seen her.
Yeah.
Maybe this movie would have been better if Jerry Ryan had been in it.
Yeah, it almost seems like an honorary admiral rank to me anyway, just because of what she went through getting the ship back. But if you look at the Starfleet admiral ranks going from captain, if you're actually fully an admiral, that means you've already gone through two other admiral ranks, because from captain, you're a fleet captain, commodore, rear admiral, vice admiral, admiral, and then fleet admiral. So, I mean, if you're a rear admiral, I think generally they're just going to call you admiral, like they call Worf commander, even though he's a lieutenant commander, you know. But anyway, yeah, it is interesting. But let me just ask you while we're on the topic of this, though. And Voyager fans are going to get really upset, I know, but hey, this is our Deep Space Nine show. It's not the Ready Room where we're talking about everything. I never liked the Janeway cameo in the movie because I felt like it was shoved into the movie just to have this connection to Voyager. And I guess it's because, like we're saying here, it didn't make sense to me why Janeway would suddenly be above Picard. That dynamic was weird to me, that with all of Picard's experience over the years as a captain, that suddenly Janeway would be an admiral giving him orders and calling him up and joking about, oh, you get all the tough assignments.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying, because as we were mentioning just a few minutes ago, obviously it's strange that she gets home and they immediately make her an admiral. Obviously, I don't think that Picard would ever be one because of the conversation he had with Kirk.
Well, he doesn't want to be one.
Yeah, he would never want to be one.
Sure.
So I have no problem if, you know, this movie was 3 or 4 years down the line and, you know, Janeway is an admiral at that point. It makes more sense. But this is very odd. And I mean, it's a fine cameo. It's kind of more just a wink. Be like, hey, we got home and they gave me a promotion.
Yeah.
It's fine. I don't have a huge problem with it. You know, I think there are much bigger issues with the film than Janeway's cameo.
Definitely.
But it is kind of it is a really odd thing, the way that she's ribbing him and stuff. It's like they don't even know each other.
Yeah, I know, right? They don't even know each other. So, well, let me ask you this: would it have been better for you if that had been Admiral Ross, not Admiral Janeway?
Yes, that would have been a nice callback, because, you know, actually, one of the few things that I can really compliment this film for is the fact that they actually mention and it seems like they are after the Dominion War. They take that into consideration here.
Yeah, you mean feels like it?
Yeah, it
obviously
feels
they
like
are.
It.
So.
When I say feels like, it's because they actually mention it and they kind of talk about it, and they talk about what the Romulans used the Remans for during the war, and all of that. It's really nicely done. So yeah, if Ross had been the admiral, that would have been pretty fantastic, a nice little cameo there, and then all the Deep Space Nine fans would have been like, oh, I know him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me tell you why that would have been a lot better. So the next topic, why is Worf on the Enterprise? We always have to address this in a TNG film, right? In the later films. So we don't get anything on screen. At the end of DS9, Worf leaves for his assignment as the Federation ambassador to Kronos, and that's all we get. And then the next time we see him, he's here, playing tactical officer again, aboard the Enterprise E in his normal uniform and everything. But what happened, and this is a retcon, because this is something that was written in by our friend Keith DeCandido, as well as Michael A. Martin and Angie Mangels in a couple of books that came later. So, you know, the A Time For series, right? That long TNG series of books. So we find out from A Time For War, A Time For Peace, that Worf decided that he wasn't really cut out to be an ambassador. And Admiral Ross reinstates his commission and his rank and assigns him to the Titan as Riker's first officer. But there was the security chief on the Enterprise E was Christine Vell. And the first Titan novel, which is Taking Wing, opens, if I remember correctly, it's been a while since I read that one, it opens with Riker deciding who he's going to bring over as his first officer, and he's trying to get Vell off the Enterprise. And she's going to go over and be on the Titan, but then Worf gets assigned by Ross, and so Vell steps back, and she's going to let Worf have that role. But then after Data is killed in Nemesis, Picard decides to keep Worf on the Enterprise, and then Vell does go over to become the first officer on the Titan.
Wow, it's like musical chairs with first officers.
Yeah, right. But Admiral Ross plays a part in Worf's move away from being the ambassador and getting him back into Starfleet, and then ultimately him being on the Enterprise in the first place in this movie. And of course, none of that's explained on screen. And these books, A Time for War, A Time for Peace, was published in October of 2004. Taking Wing was published in April 2005. So this is completely a retcon of the situation. But at least you can make that part of your headcanon if you want. At least make a little bit more sense of this.
Well, because what seems so odd is that obviously Worf has become a completely different character. You know, he was the strategic operations officer of Deep Space Nine, which was not just tactical abilities, but helping, I would think, figure out an entire sector's worth of, you know, tactical operations and the running of the station. He's very much involved with command at that point. I mean, this is an officer who is really growing, and to all of a sudden bring him back into Starfleet just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I mean, it, as we said before, it's almost as if none of that stuff happened, and this movie just doesn't take into account a lot of things, and characters really is one of them. The only characters that it really acknowledges as moving forward are Troy and Riker, which, you know, as fans, we were all super happy about that we're finally gonna have some character growth. And I would have to say the first like 10 minutes of this film was fantastic because of that.
Yeah.
The moment you get to Kolaris 3, it just steadily declines.
Yeah. Well, especially the wedding scene was great, because that's what we as fans wanted to see for so long. And I think it's really well done. And what I love about the wedding scene is that it feels like that group of actors who had been together for so many years, just being together and having fun and doing this last fun shoot together. You know, everyone feels so natural. It doesn't feel like a script that's being performed. It just feels like a bunch of friends together.
And you know who is in this movie? Wesley Crusher. That's right. Yeah. Wesley Crusher in this film. So, you know, he doesn't have a speaking role, but you do see him, especially if you're watching the widescreen version. He's there at the table.
Yeah.
So.
I believe he originally did have a little bit more of a part in here, and it got
Because,
like so many things in this movie.
If I remember, too, I'm trying to remember my lit, but I feel like he was going to be joining, at least in the books, in the film, he was supposed to be joining the Enterprise.
Yeah. As part of the engineering group.
As part of the engineering group.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently, being a traveler just was boring him. So,
I mean, at some point, you've traveled everywhere. So,
yeah,
you know,
I've been everywhere. I've seen everything. It's like, you know, I might as well come back and hang out with some friends.
I mean, it's like Worf. You know, you've been through the whole Dominion War process. You've been the ambassador to Kronos. You know, you've done it all. Why not just come back home? You know, and get on the Enterprise. Wesley was the same way.
It's great. Know? Be told no again.
Yeah. Right. No. No, Worf, we are not.
I feel so much better, Captain. Thank you.
Okay, so that's the background as to how Worf got on the Enterprise, at least the way it was retconned in the literary universe, which I'm glad that Keith did that and that Michael and Andy did that as well to help make some sense of it, at least in the big picture for your headcanon. Let's talk about drawing upon DS9. You know, it was easy with First Contact. I think we did a pretty good job with Insurrection of finding some connections with Worf's experience on DS9. Nemesis, it's a whole lot harder. So is there anything that stands out to you?
Well, apparently he... Okay, yeah. The only thing that I can really think of, Chris, that's is a standout was when he says that the Romulans fought with honor. And, yeah, you know, obviously having the experience with the Romulans in the Dominion War, and for the most part, I think a good experience with them, seeing them fight alongside, you know, what we would call the Allies, and really keeping up their end of the bargain, it was, you know, a good experience for him, and I think that puts him on a different plane when he's here. Obviously, none of them go into this trusting the Romulans at all, but, you know, I the only other thing that I can think of, too, was that moment with Deanna where he, you know, she's guiding his hand, that references some old TNG stuff a little bit. They used to be a couple, and, I mean, they're working together, yeah. But, you know, I mean, yes, those are the only things I really feel from Worf's character that get drawn from anywhere in Star Trek. Otherwise, he's just a big bag of comic relief.
He kind of is, for the most part, right? I don't know, for me, yeah, the Romulan thing is there, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. The other thing that I could see is that after he grew so much as a person on DS9, after everything that he had been through during the Dominion War, working with Sisko, having more of a serious view of very dire situations, calling out Data when Data says it appears to be a robotic arm, and Worf just gives him this look and says, very astute, like, you idiot. That's the only thing I can find that, like, shows the growth in the growth in Worf's character from when he was on TNG to now. You know, it feels like someone who has matured a lot over the course of these years that he's been away, and now he just doesn't have any time for Data's Captain Obvious moments.
This may be the most esoteric connection, but knowing that it's Irving Berlin, my guess that comes from being at Vix.
Oh, that is a really good point, because I always took that as it being a joke about what happened in Insurrection when he did not know Gilbert and Sullivan. And so now he's been studying up on composers, and so he knew it was Irving Berlin. But no, you're right. Yeah, being at Vix, being around the jazz all the time, that's the connection. Yeah.
Yeah, because that would probably be a song that Vic might still have in his repertoire. Oh, yeah, it's definitely a little bit younger. I mean, it's a little bit older than Vic's time period, but it's still close enough to fit. So
yeah. I think that's a good point. Yeah. Okay.
Now
connection. All right. So
yeah, I do have to ask you, Chris. Was it weird to you that it was like Worf beyond the Thunderdome? You know, Mad Worf running around in the Doom buggy in a post-apocalyptic looking planet where the color is desaturated, because that's what we did in that time period in films. Yeah. We just desaturated things to make them look alien. Like, it really, after seeing especially Mad Max Fury Road, I was like, this really just feels like a Mad Max movie.
Well, it's not just Worf doing that. It's that entire sequence. This is Stuart Baird wanting to have this approach to the movie. He did not understand the material that he was working with. And so we got this. The idea that Picard has this great urge to go down and drive a dune buggy around on a desert on an alien planet alone is weird. It's not something Picard would want to do. Do you think, based on the Picard that we know up to this point?
I don't think it's weird, but what's weird is that Picard is so ready to throw the prime directive out the window and drive around in a dune buggy and fly a shuttlecraft down and not be going as quickly as possible to gather these things and making sure that they're not allowing these people to see them.
Yeah.
Because they're breaking the prime directive clearly in this scene. And not only that, they shoot at them. I mean,
are those the natives of the planet, though, or those are like henchmen that Shin Zan has put there to try to capture Picard by luring him there to get the arm?
Yeah, I do not think those are henchmen. I think they say clearly at the beginning, this is a pre-industrial civilization.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So it's like...
But this is a desert area, so it is possible that these guys are working with Shin Zan and the actual natives are elsewhere.
It could be, but that's not clear enough. And so
it's not clear at all. Yeah,
I mean, still, if you're going to a planet that has an indigenous population that is pre-warp, you have to be very careful. And they don't give a flying flip about what they're doing. They come out with a dune buggy and they, you know, race all over the sand creating...
Why is Enterprise carrying a dune buggy around in the first place, right?
Okay, I actually think it makes sense to have a wheeled vehicle. I mean, that was actually smart. It's just the entire scene negates everything else that we've seen in Star Trek, especially, again, Picard and who he is. Like, I could see him wanting to try out the vehicle. I could see anybody wanting to try out that vehicle. But then and there was not the place nor the time. So it's just, it's a really awful scene. And honestly, I think for me, the moment Picard gives the middle finger to the prime directive, with that, to me, the film just goes downhill from there. The logic just flies out the window, Star Trek-wise, and even just film-wise. So,
what about the symbolism that this scene carries for all the TNG movies? There are three people in the doom buggy. You've got Picard and Data in the front seat. Worf has to ride in the back seat.
Well, that is classic TNG, where it's all about Data and Picard and really
classic
not
TNG
about
films.
And not about anybody else. And it is interesting too, because so there's the whole scene where, you know, Riker is fighting the viceroy.
Yeah, the one where he gets kicked down the bottomless pit.
We all know that's on the Enterprise.
right.
That scene feels exactly like Galaxy Quest. It feels like that scene where they're having to run through the chompers and all this stuff, and they're like, why is this even here? That's exactly what you're thinking. Why is this even here? But why isn't that Worf? Like, if you're having the tactical officer not leading the charge of the intruders on the ship? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that he's not the one having the mano-a-mano. I mean, maybe it's just because Riker didn't have enough to do in the film.
Well, no, I think the reason, and I've had the same thought, and it certainly makes more sense that Worf would be the person who would go after the Viceroy and would be the one fighting him. But because the Viceroy had been the conduit through which Shin Zan was basically raping Troy.
That makes sense.
You know, that was a personal matter for Riker. And that's why Riker went after him. So that part makes sense to me in terms of Riker's motivation. But why couldn't Riker have had Worf go with him? Or why didn't Worf follow Riker to help him?
Yeah, and they could have tag teamed it. I mean, like beating the crap out of this guy. Because they both dated, you know, her. So,
I mean, forget the part that they both dated her, just the fact that Worf is the tactical officer, security officer. He should be going. Now, the fact that he also dated Troy, maybe that's another motivation for him.
Yeah, that would have been really nice to see. I also thought it was interesting that for the most part, when they beam down to Romulus, that Worf's a part of that with the away team. So the head of the tactical, you know, department on the Enterprise is going with this away team. But I thought, you have sent down almost your entire command staff in one beam down. Is that really the wisest move? Like,
well, if things go wrong, remember that Argyle lives on the battle bridge. And although we don't see a battle bridge on the Enterprise E, maybe it does still have a battle bridge. And Argyle can take over. So, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Well, I know from drawings from John Eaves that the Enterprise E can separate the saucer. So there would be a battle bridge.
Yeah,
so
you would need some kind of command center.
Yeah, exactly.
In Star Drive, yeah.
Well, it needs to be right there on top of where it separates, of course. But I think that was an interesting thing to me to see. But it also, at least Worf being there, okay, that made sense when they beamed down, since, you know, he's the main person in charge of making sure that the captain is safe at that point.
Yeah.
And so I really like that. What struck me as odd was that they have Data there, but I feel like Crusher should have been on the away team as the doctor to get the information that Data is trying to get with the tricorder. It's like, it makes no sense for Data to be there, but it does make sense for the doctor to be there to be reading the life signs and figuring out what's going on in that sense.
But Matthew, you're forgetting something very important here. Gates McFadden didn't have top billing on this movie.
No, she didn't, unfortunately. Yeah. Therefore, what I have to say, though, is that I also like that her and Picard, there's this undertone at the wedding. Like, he comes and sits down next to her across from Riker and Troy. And there's almost this undertone as if there's something going on between him and Crusher.
Mm.
That's what I got in it, and which was really interesting because I feel like it's just the way that the actors were playing with each other.
Yeah.
So one of the few things that I really like about Nemesis as well was that feeling that I got that these two characters had started to get closer together. I thought that was really nice.
Well, one connection to that, again, going into the literary universe for something that ties into this movie, is how did the Romulans get Picard's DNA in the first place? This is from the book Death in Winter. There was an operative at the wedding of Beverly and Jack, and Picard was there attending the wedding, and they got his DNA, and that's how Shinzon was created in the first place.
Yeah, which is one of the main reasons that the literary universe is just fantastic for filling in these holes, especially for Swiss cheese films like Nemesis, where you really do need those writers to come in and fill that stuff in right away. Because, I like that a lot in this film. And again, I have to say, the first 10 minutes of this film feels so right. Like, everything is going so right, as in the blue skies. And it's frustrating to me because I remember being in the theater watching this movie and feeling that too. And then by the time I came out of the movie, I was just discouraged as a Star Trek
fan. Yeah, I was
fan.
Too. I remember walking out. I was just so disappointed. And I felt like you know, the tagline was "A crew's last journey begins," I believe, right?
Yeah, it was something to that effect, as a, you know, like, this could be the end. So
yeah, could be.
This could be their last hurrah. And then you're like, if this is their last hurrah, like, that's really the best you can do? Like,
yeah, they were hedging their bets, right? Because it wasn't like a crew's last journey. It was like a crew's last journey begins. Like, maybe it could be continued in another film. But I remember leaving the theater anyway and being very disappointed and thinking, yeah, this is the last one.
I feel like they just pulled out of Stuart Baird's magic bag of cliches, because this whole film is like just riddled with terrible film cliches and terrible film tropes. And especially with, you know, again, we have like a character that is going to die, and you immediately have already set up, but they could always come back. It's, I mean, I feel like it's done even worse than what people complain about with Star Trek and Darkness. It's just so blatantly obvious that you literally have another Data, and you've given them all the memories. You're just waiting for the software to catch up at that point, it seems.
I hate that part. Okay, so back to Worf. One thing I wanted to talk about, and it may not take long, but how could they have used Worf in the movie? How could they have used him more effectively? The one thing that stands out to me is the Romulans. I mentioned earlier that I was going to come back to the Romulans. It feels to me like from the Dominion War, Worf having to work with the Romulans as allies through much of that war. And, you know, in reality for him, there would have been a lot more going on involving the Romulans than what we saw on the screen. You would think that they could have leveraged his experience working with the Romulans more effectively in a story where they have to actually go to Romulus.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, what could Worf have done in the film? And my thought process, one, was that. But at the same time, what if Worf was part of a joint task force with the Romulans to infiltrate the Scimitar to help try and take it down? Yeah. And they're working with, you know, Denatra's people and him and a few other Starfleet people, you know, really give Worf this opportunity to have this growing moment of working alongside Romulans towards a common goal, shoulder to shoulder. You know, like that would have been something that would have been really great to see, especially for that character. And as you just mentioned, that kind of the headcanon of, okay, we know Worf was ahead of strategic operations at Deep Space Nine during the Dominion War when they're working with the Romulans. This guy has to have a lot of experience with this at this point, even if he didn't really like it at the time.
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of thing that you can put into a movie like this, and it still works perfectly fine for a general audience because that's who they're always going after with these movies. You don't have to know that background in order for it to work. But if you do know that background, it really enhances the story for you and really connects it to the universe so much more.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that I feel like, you know, Worf could have done in the film was just not be the comic relief every line he gives. You know, give Worf some more serious things to do in the film. I don't mind the wedding thing where Worf is complaining about Irving Berlin.
Yeah, that was funny.
You know, that's funny. It kind of feels Worf, you know, like to be in that place.
It does feel like Worf. Yeah.
You know, I mean, gosh, his former love is getting married to somebody else, and he's not married anymore, you know, because his wife died. I don't know why a guy wouldn't be drunk at a wedding at that point. So it all makes sense. There's another Deep Space Nine connection for us. But no, just having him be able to have some more serious lines and something to really offer to the film and not get told no so much, but get told yes more. It's like, this guy is not the same character who left. He's somebody who's really smart and done really well where he was, and now he's come back. He should be even better.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I would think he wouldn't want to stay in this role too long under those circumstances. I mean, if you think about...
I know it's the flagship of the Federation, you know, and it's the top-of-the-line vessel, but still, you know, I feel like Worf, he's got a lot of pride, and he should have a lot of pride in what he accomplished at Deep Space Nine, and then he was an ambassador. It's like, I would think that he would have more fire in his belly as a Klingon to want to move forward in his career than just kind of stay stagnant.
Yeah. Well, and that can happen after the film, because when the crew is all split up after this, then he's kind of forced into a new path. You know, even if it's with Picard, it's still a new path because, you know, the dynamics are all different. Yeah.
Right. Which I think is a great role for him.
So I guess that is the connection that we have, and that's how they could have used him better. So let's recap Worf's journey, just looking back at these past four episodes that we've done. What are your thoughts on Worf going from TNG to DS9 and then to here? Obviously, you can tell we feel let down by the final portion of this, where we feel like he took a major step backwards, but at least up to that point. What are your thoughts on how the films, the TNG appearances, work together with the DS9 growth?
Well, it's very clear that it works really well from Generations going into Deep Space Nine. And then, of course, from Deep Space Nine to First Contact works pretty well. It's a little less smooth when you get to Insurrection. And by the time you get to Nemesis, it just feels like... I feel like it feels like a slap in the face to Worf and the character and where he had been. And whoever it was, and it was John Logan who wrote this movie, but it just feels like... there wasn't a lot of time put into making sure that all of the characters were at their peak.
Yeah. Should have been in the final outing.
Right. But I mean,
if you look at The Undiscovered Country, you come away from that feeling like that was a wonderful send off for the whole TOS cast, right?
Right. I mean, beyond Uhura not knowing how to split Klingon and having to pull out books.
Well, that was Nick Meyer wanting
that,
to have. Sort of
right.
tangible things
right.
like dictionaries.
Other than that, yes, you're right. That film comes off wonderfully. And every character, I think, does kind of have a couple of moments to shine. I mean, in fact, when I say that about Uhura, she's also the one who remembers that they have all of the equipment for, detecting gaseous anomalies. And she comes up with the way to destroy, Chang's ship. So... Worf, unfortunately, doesn't even get that opportunity here. He gets Ouija board with with Troy. So it's an interesting journey, but by the time you get to Nemesis, it's an uninteresting journey. And that's a frustration.
Yeah. Well, when we had Michael on the Orb, back on the Orb 96, if I remember correctly, he talked to us a little bit about how he wasn't even interested in doing this film, really, because when he got the script, he can see there's really nothing for Worf to do here.
It's true. I mean, you could have almost had anybody play the character who is the right size and maybe had him go into a recording booth and do some ADR. He wouldn't even had to have put on the makeup and showed up almost. It's almost that bad.
Yeah. Well, my thoughts on the journey are, like you said, it works really well. I think the transition from TNG Season 7 into Generations and onto DS9 works really well, which we talked about both TNG Season 7 and Generations in the first part of the series. And First Contact works really well, bringing him in during the DS9 run. Insurrection... I think there's enough in Insurrection that you can infer things that he was doing that we didn't get to see in the movie, where Picard was actually utilizing his experience more. You can at least, in your mind, assume that that was taking place. But in Nemesis, there's really no evidence of any of that, even to the point where he's just being told no by Picard again, just like we're in, Season 4 of TNG.
It feels exactly like Season 4 of TNG right. for Worf. I mean, the only thing that's different is his hair in this film.
Yeah, and he's wearing red instead of gold. That's about
Which
it.
Which is an interesting thing, too, that they do keep that Deep Space Nine connection that he's apparently on the command track, but he's in the tactical officer's role, so...
Yeah, well...
It almost makes me wonder if that's just a mistake, because that's his uniform from Deep Space Nine, and they just pulled it off the rack and put it back on him.
Ross is like, I've been keeping this for you in my closet here. Here you go. Okay, so there are two ways to look at that. I think in reality, it's basically what you're saying, is that they brought him back. Everyone had been accustomed to seeing him wear... red on Deep Space Nine, so let's put him in red. But his part is going to be tactical officer, so he's back in operations. If you take the literary retcon that we talked about, then it makes sense, because Ross had brought him back in and had assigned him to be the first officer of the Titan, which is a command position, and he was just on the Enterprise E filling in for Vel because she was on leave. And I really mean she was on leave, I'm not joking, that's the story. And therefore, he is on the command track. He's just filling in as security officer temporarily. And in that way, it makes perfect sense that he would be in red. Unfortunately, that story was written 2, 3, 4 years after this movie was written. So that's not what was going on in terms of the minds of the team that put this movie together.
You know what's also really unfortunate is Riker is a captain, but he doesn't actually get to wear a captain's uniform with the jacket. No, he still has the jumpsuit. And I don't understand that, because any other time, even on Deep Space Nine, when you would see another captain, they would actually have the captain's uniform on with, you know, the jacket. And I was so surprised that they did not give, you know, Jonathan Frakes the captain's uniform, basically, because he is a captain in this film.
Yeah, but I think it's a little bit easier to slip out of that jumpsuit, Matthew. So maybe that's a consideration that Riker likes, you know, being able to just strip down quickly.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, and when he's in his quarters, he definitely likes it that way, because he just has a silk bathrobe. So,
but a command red one, right?
A command. Well, actually, isn't it blue in this film? It's a nice blue, I think he has. Anyway, but yeah.
Oh, that's the one that he just wears normally, but he's got a command bathrobe.
He's got a command, command robe.
The command robe, yeah.
I can totally see Riker in the command robe on the bridge of the Enterprise. Somebody get me my slippers.
That's right. Oh, but they're Starfleet slippers, so they'll probably be high heels.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It'll be a nice 3-inch heel there.
Yeah, something really uncomfortable to wear on the battlefield. So, All right. So that's the journey. We've been wrapping up these shows by giving our thoughts on the movie as a whole. I feel like we've kind of done that all the way through this episode with Nemesis. I would want to close by just saying that my thoughts on this movie, like, I don't hate this movie, but there are so many elements of this movie that are just disappointing or poorly directed or poorly edited, bad choices on the cutting room floor, writing for different characters, especially Worf, that's just not appropriate or not there, that it's hard for me to really connect with this movie. There are moments that I love. We talked about the beginning, especially the wedding thing, I think is fantastic. I love the scene at the end when Picard and the crew are toasting Data. I love the fact that it's a callback to the search for Spock. You know, it's a callback for when they're in Kirk's apartment and they're toasting Spock. I love the fly around of the E being refurbished because it's an homage to the motion picture. Even the music is there. And even the concept of this movie, I don't have a problem with, but I think it's a difficult concept to pull off. Like, Tom Hardy doesn't look enough like Patrick Stewart for you to really buy it. When he turns the light on and Picard sees him, and then Patrick Stewart does a wonderful job of acting, and he gives this look like he's shocked that he's seeing himself when he was younger, and he doesn't know how to react to that. Wonderful job by Patrick Stewart. But the problem is, it's hard to buy into it because Tom Hardy doesn't look like Patrick Stewart. And like, how do you do that? You know, it's a story concept where you almost need to do it with CGI in some way where it really looks like young Patrick Stewart.
No, I completely agree. And now, obviously, after him being Bane in the Dark Knight Rises film, all I can hear him being like is, "You were merely adopted the darkness. I was born in it.
That's right.
Molded by it.
On Remus."
That's exactly right.
In the caves of Remus.
In the mines of Remus.
I lived in the darkness.
That's right.
All my life.
no, you make a great point that the concept of it is very tough. And in fact, it would have been better if they had just had Patrick Stewart playing both roles like they had originally planned.
Although I don't know how you pull that off exactly either there.
Well, I mean, Patrick Stewart's a good enough actor to make you do that and to make you believe that. This immediately pulls you out, whereas that would have had a much better chance of making you believe true. You know, they could have given him some makeup, you know, in the sense like they could give him a scar on his face or something like that that really sold you the fact that this person had been through hell and back.
You'd have to write the story where Shinzon had already aged to the point where the Romulans were almost ready to replace Picard in Starfleet.
Right. And you could have still given him the thing where, you know, because he's been aged, unless he has a new transfusion of DNA, then he'll die in like 6 months to a year or something. So anyway, that's really the hard part about this film is some the stuff like that. I think the thing that for me that stands out, one, again, I love the first 10 minutes of this film. I really do. Every time I watch it, the first 10 minutes help me forget that the rest of the movie is kind of rubbish and it makes me hopeful. And then I get to Kolaris 3 and I just remember how bad the film starts to get. And it is because, you know, I think J.J. Abrams proved that somebody who is passionate about something for the most part and enjoys the story that they're working on and enjoys the universe actually helps if they have the right people around them. And nobody at Paramount really cared about Star Trek at this point other than trying to earn them money. And they didn't understand the core of what made Star Trek good. And it really showed here. You know, John Logan is a great fan and a great Star Trek writer, but what he wrote in the script, a lot of the good stuff got cut out.
Got cut out, yeah.
And got trimmed down.
It's not that they had a bad writer, it's that they had a bad director, or I'm not even going to say a bad director, it was the wrong choice for this material. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and what also happened too is that there are some nonsensical story elements that really, especially as a Star Trek fan, we look for good story, good connection, and I would say that most Star Trek fans, I think, are really smart. So you need a smart film, and this one's just not smart. And so, unfortunately for me, beyond all the other Star Trek films, this is actually my least favorite Star Trek film. That doesn't mean I hate it. It's just my least favorite.
Yeah, this is my least favorite film as well. I will also say in closing that with this being the last outing for the TNG crew, I actually like the fact that Data gave his life to save Picard at the end, because Data's entire storyline from Encounter at Farpoint forward was that he was endeavoring to be human. And in the end, he sacrificed himself to save someone who was so important to him. And I think that that was the culmination of his journey to become human. What I don't like is what you talked about earlier, having before there. It just completely guts the emotional impact of Data's sacrifice. I was watching this last weekend to prepare for this show, and I tweeted at the time that the ending of Nemesis should be Riker talking to Picard, and then Riker leaves. The next scene should be Picard walking down the corridor, and then you go to the fly around of the Enterprise in space dock, and you're done. And all this mess about Picard telling before about Data should not be in there at all. You know, you finish it that way. Picard's letting Riker go to take command of the Titan. Picard has remembered Data with the crew. He's coming to terms with that on his own. He walks down the corridor. He's kind of upbeat. He sees that there are new horizons. It's a new chapter of his life beginning, and then you're done.
That, or what I think would have been really cool, add on top of that, maybe Picard going to their, you know, whatever they call their 10 forward on that Enterprise, and having him watch the Titan fly away.
Yeah,
you know, I think that would have been a really cool thing as he watches, you know, almost as if like a father, you're watching your son kind of go on his journey, like going away to college, but Riker's going on to the unknown. And so I think something like that, just would have really encapsulated this idea that Star Trek is still moving forward and everything, instead of this, well, we're actually just going to, we're just going to undercut our biggest moment in the film completely.
Yeah, and do it right away, like right after, right, almost.
Right.
So I think what you said could work, although what I would want to see at the end of this film is, I think that after the emotional impact of Data's death, toasting Data, Riker saying his farewell to Picard, you've got to get out of it quickly at that point. Like, that's your story. You've got to get out of it. So maybe Picard, maybe Riker leaves Picard's quarters, and then we cut. Picard's already in 10 forward or its equivalent.
Yep.
Really quick scene. You see the Titan go away. Maybe Guinan's there with Picard because they have such a close connection through the series. But that scene's really quick. And then you have Picard walking down the corridor with a smile and you're done. Roll credits. You got to get out quickly at that point. But the whole before thing, it was such a bad move. I can't believe that they let that go into the movie.
And I don't want to sound like a hypocrite here, because there are films where I mean, again, I'll mention Into Darkness, because I think people, it just immediately kind of feels like that. I feel like that works to me 10 times better than this. And part of it is just because of the way it's referencing something else, but also what it was actually doing for the character of Kirk, because it's a growing moment and all that stuff. This with Data, like you said, it actually just really does undercut his story about becoming almost fully human.
Yeah.
And because now he'll just continue, and his sacrifice really won't have meant anything, because that B4 is going to pick up right where that Data left off, basically, but he won't have made that sacrifice, so it won't mean anything. It's just, it's a frustrating story element, you know, whereas other rebirths out there tend to mean something for whoever the character is being reborn, whether it's Spock in the original, you know, series, or, you know, I think Kirk in the Into Darkness, and well, hopefully what comes next and beyond. So
Beyond.
All right. Well, there we go. All right. So that is our look at Worf's journey from TNG to DS9 and back to TNG in this case. So let us know what you think about Worf's journey. The best place to have a conversation about that with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just go to Facebook, type B-A-B-E-L into the search field. It will come right up. It should come up in the list. You can also click discussion on the website, on the menu bar, or in the links underneath the streaming player on the episode pages. That'll take you to the Babel Conference as well. It's a closed group, so you need to click join if you're not yet a member, and we'll let you right on in. And also, you can contact us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. And also, you can send us an email through the website, trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email automatically. You can also send us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. That's the word speak and the word pipe together, .com/trekfm. Well, Worf is just one of the many, many topics we've been talking about here on the network recently, so here's a quick look at a few of these.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
You've heard Chief Trip sign on. I'm serious, Ken. Actually, out of the chair, please.
Okay. God.
I guess the Commodore has the con!
Earl Grey.
Did you really write down Groppler Zorn on this list?
I was just kidding. What fruit did he like before he got to apples?
The Ready Room.
I think all of us Star Trek fans at one point or another probably retreat into this universe we love, Star Trek, that is, it's a fictional world.
What are you talking about, Zachary? Are you suggesting that, like, fans might decide to buy microphones and, like, talk about it like it's real for hours on end?
Commentary, Trek Stars.
In the first movie, it was really like, you know, let's go race some cars, you know?
Yeah.
And then let's go steal some TV VCR combos.
Yeah. Is that really what it is?
Yes, that's what they were stealing.
That's awesome.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider with Apple. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. Go to the website, stream from the show pages, download the MP3 files. We have so many ways for you to get our shows, and we hope you'll go check them all out. Be sure to check out the master feed. If you're new to Trek FM, you can sample every episode of everything that we do in one feed right there. It's a great way to get an idea for the breadth of topics that we talk about here on Trek FM, because there are so many of them. Well, Matthew, when you're not trying to figure out what other way you can use Worf as comic relief in your next story, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. I am also on our general geek show called the 602 Club. We have so much we want to talk about as fans and all the other universes, and we needed an outlet for that here on Trek FM. So that's the 602 Club. I hope you'll check that out. It's so much fun each week talking about a new topic. You can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations, which is a Star Wars podcast I do with my friend John Mills, and you'll find that on iTunes under Aggressive Negotiations.
And we should also mention people can find your co-host there, John Mills, on Commentary Trek Stars as well.
Yes, you can. So we are both here on the network. Very proud to be. Now, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out whether it's the mustard yellow or the maroon that you're supposed to be wearing under that uniform, where can we find you?
Yeah, I know it's tough. You know, when I'm not sure about that, what I do is I just pull out my Ouija board and I just ask it to tell me, and it moves my hands. I say, like, am I supposed to be wearing mustard yellow? And it will slide over to no. And then I know why I should put on the maroons. But when I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network hosting The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series. We rotate through week after week, or actually show after show. I don't do it weekly anymore because of my work schedule, but I do try to do it bi-weekly. You can also find me on Hyper Channel, which is our short news show. That's something that I do by myself, and I do a couple of times a week. And then you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name up there, C. Brian Jones, Brian with a Y, and articles should come up. Should have a new one up pretty soon right now, I think. And also, if you want to find me on Twitter, my username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me under that name on Facebook, pretty much everywhere, and then I'm there in the Babel Conference too. I'd also like to take a moment here to thank our associate producers on The Orb. It's thanks to our APs that we're able to get this show out to you guys. And those are Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. So we really thank Ruth, Will, and Ken for helping us here. Will is also our content manager here on the network and previously was a co-host on Warp 5. Ken Tripp you can find these days on Standard Orbit with Norm and Jeffrey, our original series show. Everyone doing a great job here contributing to the network. And Ruth, Will, and Ken support us through Patreon. And if you would like to help out the network and keep podcasts coming, because we are listener supported and we will go away if we don't have listener support, because otherwise we just can't fund the network. It costs a lot of money to put out all these shows. You can find out everything that you need to know at patreon.com/trekafilm. That's patreon.com/trekafilm. If you go there, you'll find out about all the perks that we have for you. You can find out how you can get on mic and talk Star Trek with us in the Patrons Roundtable. You can also become an associate producer of your favorite show or shows. We have different levels for that. We also have our exclusive website, Patron Zone, where we do early releases of shows, and we have wallpapers and avatars and ringtones and occasional video content and other things. Lots of things for you there in exchange for your help, but basically it's just a way to help us make sure we can keep the lights on, pay the very high costs of hosting and distribution for the shows, and we really thank everyone who's supporting us there, patreon.com/trekfm, and we really thank you for considering becoming a patron of the network.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.